Contemplation, consequently, by which the intellect has a higher knowledge of God, is called mystical theology, meaning the secret wisdom of God. For this wisdom is secret to the very intellect that receives it. Saint Dionysius, on this account, refers to contemplation as a ray of darkness. The prophet Baruch declares of this wisdom, "There is no one who knows its way or can think of its pathics." To reach union with God, the intellect must obviously blind itself to all the paths along which it can travel. Aristotle teaches that just as the sun is total darkness to the eyes of a bat, so the brightest light in God is complete darkness to our intellect. And he teaches, in addition, that the loftier and the clearer the things of God are in themselves, the more unknown and obscure they are to us. The apostle also affirms this teaching: that which is highest in God is least known by men. We would never finish if we continued to quote passages and present arguments as proof that there is no ladder among all created, knowable things by which the intellect can reach this high Lord. Rather, it should be known that if the intellect did desire to use all or any of these objects as approximate means to this union, they would be not merely an exuberance to it, but also an occasion of many errors and deceptions in the ascent of this mount. Chapter 9, Book 2. We can gather from what has been said that to be prepared for this divine union, the intellect must be cleansed and emptied of everything relating to sense, divested and liberated of everything clearly apprehensible, inwardly pacified and silenced, and supported by faith alone, which is the only proximate and proportionate means to union with God. For the likeness between faith and God is so close that no other difference exists than that between believing in God and seeing Him. Just as God is infinite, faith proposes Him to us as infinite. As there are three persons in the one God, it presents Him to us in this way. And as God is darkness to our intellect, so does faith dazzle and blind us. Only by means of faith, in divine light exceeding all understanding, does God manifest Himself to the soul. The more intense a man's faith, the closer is his union with God. Saint Paul indicated this in the passage cited above. He who would be united with God must believe. This means that a man must walk by faith in his journey to God. The intellect must be blind and dark, and abide in faith alone, because it is joined with God under this cloud. And as David proclaims, God is hidden under the cloud. He set darkness under his feet, and he rose above the cherubim and flew upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness and the dark water his hiding place. This darkness under God's feet and of his hiding place, and the dark water of his dwelling, denote the obscurity of faith in which he is enclosed. the verse stating that he rose above the cherubim and flew upon the wings of the wind allude to how God soars above all understanding. The cherubim typify those who understand or contemplate. The wings of the wind signify the subtle ideas and lofty concepts of the Spirit. Above these is his being, which no man can reach through his own efforts. In Scripture, we read figuratively of this, that when Solomon had completed the temple, God descended in darkness and filled it so that the children of Israel were unable to see. Solomon then said, "The Lord has promised to dwell in darkness." God also covered with darkness when he appeared to Moses on the mount. And as often as God communicated at length with someone, he appeared in darkness. This is evident in the book of Job, where Scripture asserts that God spoke to Job from the dark air. All this darkness symbolizes the obscurity of faith with which the divinity is clothed while communicating itself to the soul. This darkness will be dispelled when, as St. Paul states, that which is in part is taken away, and that which is perfect comes. We also find a fairly good figure of this obscurity of faith in the scriptural narration about the militia of Gideon. According to the account, all of the soldiers had lamps in their hands, yet did not see the light, because the lamps were hidden in darkness within earthenware jars. But when these jars were broken, the soldiers immediately beheld the shining light. Faith typified by three clay jars contains the divine light. When faith has reached its end and is shattered by the ending and breaking of this mortal life, the glory and the light of the divinity, the content of faith, will at once begin to shine. Manifestly, then, union with God in this life and direct communication with him demands that one be united with the darkness, in which, as Solomon said, God promised to dwell, and that one approach the dark air in which God was pleased to reveal his secrets to Job. A man must take in darkness the earthenware jars of Gideon and hold in his hands the works of his will, the lamp, the union of love, though in the darkness of faith, so that when the clay jar of this life, which is all that impedes the light of faith, is broken, he may see God face to face in glory. We must discuss now in particular all the concepts and apprehensions of the intellect, the hindrance and the harm they cause along the mad road of faith, and the proper conduct of the soul. We do so that the soul may profit rather than suffer harm from either sensory or spiritual apprehensions. Chapter 10. To discuss in particular the advantage and the harm which intellectual concepts and apprehensions cause to the soul's faith, which is natural and supernatural apprehensions of the intellect. Later, then, in a more logical order, we shall be able to guide the intellect through them into the night and darkness of faith. Our division will be as concise as possible. It is noteworthy that the intellect can get ideas and concepts in two ways, naturally and supernaturally. Natural knowledge includes everything the intellect can understand by way of the bodily senses through reflection. Supernatural knowledge comprises everything imparted to the intellect in a way transcending its natural ability and capacity. This supernatural knowledge is subdivided into corporeal and spiritual. The corporeal and made up of two kinds: knowledge originating from the exterior bodily senses, and that received from the interior bodily senses, including all the imagination can apprehend, form, or fashion. The spiritual is also made up of two kinds, distinct and particular knowledge, and vague, dark, and general knowledge. The particular knowledge includes four kinds of distinct apprehensions communicated to the spirit without the means of bodily senses: visions, revelations, locutions, and spiritual feelings. The dark and general knowledge, contemplation, which is imparted in faith, is of one kind only. We have to lead the soul to this contemplation by guiding it through all these other apprehensions, and beginning with the first, divesting it of them. Chapter 11. The first kind of knowledge referred to in the preceding chapter is that which originates naturally. Since we already discussed this kind of knowledge in the first book, where we guided the soul through the night of sense, we shall have nothing to say of it here. There we presented appropriate doctrine about this knowledge. Our discussion in this chapter will deal only with the supernatural knowledge which reaches the intellect by way of the exterior bodily senses: sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. Through these senses, spiritual persons can, and usually do, perceive supernatural representations in objects. As for sight, they are wont to have visions of images and persons from the other life, of saints, of the good and bad angels, and of unusual lights and splendors. Through hearing, they apprehend certain extraordinary words, sometimes from the envisioned persons, and at other times without seeing the one who speaks. With the sense of smell, they sometimes notice sensibly the sweetest fragrances without knowledge of their origin. Also, it happens in regard to taste that they experience very exquisite savors. And concerning touch, they feel extreme delight, at times so intense that all of the bones and marrow rejoice, flourish, and bathe in it. The delight is usually termed spiritual unction, because in pure souls it passes from the spirit to the senses, and it is common with spiritual persons. It is an overflow from the affection and devotion of the sensible spirit, which each person receives in his own way. It must be known that even though these apprehensions come to the bodily senses from God, one must never rely on them or accept them. A man should rather flee from them completely and have no desire to determine whether they be good or bad. The more exterior or corporal they are, the less certain is their divine origin. God's communication is more commonly and appropriately given to the spirit, in which there is greater security and profit for the soul than to the senses, when ordinarily there is extreme danger and room for deception. Thinking that these supernatural communications are identical with what is felt, the bodily senses usually set themselves up as arbiter and judge over them. But the communications are as different from what is felt as is the body from the soul, and sensibility from reason. The bodily sense is as ignorant of rational matters as a beast of burden. Indeed, it is more ignorant of them, and still more of spiritual matters. He who esteems these apprehensions is in serious error, an extreme danger of being deceived, or at least he will hinder his spiritual growth, because, as we mentioned, these corporeal perceptions bear no portion to what is spiritual. These manifestations ought always to be considered diabolical more certainly than divine, for the devil possesses greater leeway in influencing the exterior and corporeal part of man. He can deceive the soul more readily through this action than through a more interior and spiritual kind. The more exterior these corporeal objects and forms, the less probably they are to the interior and spiritual part of the soul. This is due to the extreme distance and disparity between the corporeal and spiritual. Even though some spiritual nourishment results from these corporeal communications, which is always the case when they have a divine origin, it is far less than when the communications are more spiritual and interior. As a result, they are a ready occasion for the breeding of error, presumption, and vanity. Palpable, tangible, and material as they are, they strongly affect the senses, so that one's judgment they seem more worthwhile. A man then, forsaking faith, will follow after these communications, believing that their light is the guide and means to his goal, which is union with God. But the more importance he gives to these communications, the farther he strays from faith, the way and means. Furthermore, a person receiving these apprehensions often develops secretly a rather fine opinion of himself, that now he is someone in God's eyes. Such a view is contrary to humility. The devil, too, is adept at suggesting to the individual a secret self-satisfaction which becomes truly obvious at times. He often purveys objects to the senses, affording to the sense of sight images of saints and most beautiful lights, and to the hearing dissembled words, and to the sense of smell fragrant odors, and he puts sweetness in one's mouth and delight in the sense of touch. He does all of this so that by enticing persons through these sensory objects, he may induce them into many evils. Such representations and feelings, consequently, must always be rejected. Even though some may be from God, this rejection is no affront to him. Neither will one, upon voluntarily dismissing them, cease to receive the fruit of God that God wishes to produce through these communications. The reason is that if the corporeal vision or feeling of the senses has a divine origin, it produces its effect in the spirit at the very moment of its perception, without allowing any deliberation about wanting or not wanting it. This is likewise so with the more interior communications. Since God grants these favors without the individual's own ability and effort, he causes the desired effect of these favors without this ability and effort. For this is an effect he produces passively in the spirit. The good effect, accordingly, does not depend upon wanting or not wanting the communication. Were fire to come into immediate contact with a person's flesh, that person's desire not to get burned would hardly be helpful, for the fire will produce its effect necessarily. So too with good visions and sensible communications. Even when a person dismisses them, they produce their effect first and foremost in the soul rather than in the body.